Greetings, everybody. I'm Isha Das, the Spiritual Director of the Assisi Institute in Rochester, New York, and I want to welcome all of you to another podcast in the series of Wrestling with God. I'm really excited about the topic today and my guest, Ryan Kurzak. The topic is how Kriya Yoga works. And if you're not familiar with the term, Kriya Yoga was brought to the United States by Paramahansa Yogananda, Swami from India, in 1920. And he taught many other people and had disciples. One of those disciples was Roy Eugene Davis. And Roy passed on everything that Yogananda had taught him about Kriya Yoga and ordained a number of people who were able to teach Kriya Yoga also. I was ordained by Roy and Ryan was ordained by Roy. Kriya Yoga is, first of all, it's a powerful technique that transforms our nervous system, our astral body, and allows us to go into deeper states of self-realization and God-realization. It's also a whole lifestyle that supports our spiritual evolution. Again, I'm really thrilled to have Ryan with us today. As I already stated, Ryan was ordained by Roy and has a wonderful teaching ministry, really spread all over the United States and beyond. So Ryan, do you want to add a little bit to your biography for us?
No, I think that's pretty straightforward. You know, I met Mr. Davis when I was in my really early 20s, around 20 years old. And I began practicing Kriya Yoga with him. And then a few years later was ordained by him to teach. And other than that, that's about it, really.
Good. And those of you familiar with the Assisi Institute know for the past three summers, Ryan has come here and has conducted a retreat, helped myself and Swami Nirvanananda to conduct a retreat. And just as a start, I just want to say I have the utmost respect for Ryan and his teaching. I said this to him the other day, kind of using a Christian word in the context of Kriya Yoga, but he's a wonderful apostle for Kriya Yoga, maybe a more general way of saying that, a wonderful ambassador for Kriya Yoga. So again, Ryan, it's wonderful to have you with me in this conversation. Let me start here, and I would like you to comment on it.
Okay.
And I think it will give people an understanding of how Kriya Yoga works. I like to say to people, we go to God and God realization, not as angels, but as human beings. And the human nervous system is a wonderful boon. It's a wonderful gift. When it operates in an optimal way, all the channels for self-realization and God-realization just naturally bubble up. And Kriya Yoga as a lifestyle and Kriya Yoga as a meditation technique really help to purify the nervous system and prepare it for higher states of consciousness. What do you want to add to that comment on that?
Well, I just want to make sure I heard what you said correctly. You did say that we come to this practice not as angels, but as human beings, correct?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Well, so that's important because Sri Yukteswar, Yogananda's teacher, in his book, The Holy Science, he talks about the evolution of consciousness coming from spirit and then down to creation, where you get the rocks and the inanimate kingdom, and then their plants come around, and then plants develop, the consciousness develops the ability to move around and do things, and animals evolve, and then eventually human beings come about. And in that process of moving from, you know, the inanimate to plants to animals to human beings, that's a moving back towards source, to spirit. And so anyone who is in a human body, whether they're acting like an animal or not, on the evolutionary scale, they are already moving closer to source. And the reason I bring this up is because in the Holy Science, Sri Yukteswar describes that after you go from animal to human, that's not the end, that the next step in the evolution, the process, is for what we consider to be human or humanity to become divine, which is the devata state or the angelic state. And so We don't come at it as humans, but we are meant, or excuse me, we don't come at it as angels. We come at it as humans because that's when we can start thinking. But we are meant to, through practice, kind of continue this evolution, this experience into an angelic state. And so that's really why we do this. And the purification process you talked about you know, in Kriya Yoga, we're supposed to practice tapas. And tapas is really a burning away of everything that prevents us from recognizing, feeling, experiencing, being that free spirit that we are. So we are human, absolutely. And our purpose, our direction through our spiritual practice is to burn away everything so that we can finally experience the reality of ourselves as light or a deva or an angelic presence.
Yeah, how I like to say it to people, and I think it's the same thing that you're saying, is we gradually go through a process of divinization where we become divine. I like to say to people, and I actually say it with humility if it's properly understood, we're meant to walk the earth as gods, as angelic beings, as people participating in a divine life. So could you just say what you think, particularly for somebody out there who maybe is new to Kriya Yoga, how does Kriya Yoga, both, again, the meditation techniques and the lifestyle, help us in this process of transformation, of becoming more and more divine?
Yeah. So part of the idea of becoming more and more divine really is becoming more harmonious and organized with who we are and the energy field around us and spirit all around us. And so the processes of Kriya Yoga, it's often taught as though it's a meditation technique. Like you learn this technique and then you just do the technique and everything seems to work out. And that's really good. And that's an oversimplification of the process. But the beginning of Kriya Yoga is practicing the yamas and niyamas, which are truthfulness, contentment, surrender, and God. There's a list of them. And by practicing these things, we are beginning to essentially organize the program of our life. And it's just like when your computer is working well, it can process things quickly, it can process things efficiently, and it knows what it's doing. So the same thing with our consciousness. When our consciousness is harmonized, it will be able to experience higher states of consciousness. And through the application of the yamas and niyamas, we gain the capacity to do that. And then after we have the capacity to do that, then when we begin meditating, we begin preparing the ground to actually recognize that you are not just flesh, blood, a personality, and a name. You start to recognize that you are much more than that. So the whole process is really just one of sort of a reorganization of our attention into sort of a more holistic appreciation of what's real.
All right, something you kind of touched on it. This may be a tough question. Maybe not. What does it look like as we become more divine, more evolved, more angelic? Like on the ground in day-to-day life, how does that manifest?
Okay. So my thoughts on that are, if we take the idea of the yamas and niyamas, or maybe just for sticking with the theme of Shriktishwara's approach in the holy science, Shriktishwara says that there are eight bondages that kind of keep us in a state of confusion. And those bondages are contempt, shame, fear, grief, disgust, tribalism, attachment, and conceit. And so a lot of people experience those things based on how they've been raised or what they take in from the culture. But when you begin sort of working that out to deciding that, you know what, I'm not going to practice tribalism. I'm not going to be conceited. I'm going to try to aim to be helpful in the world, to sort of see opportunities and possibilities of service beyond myself. When that becomes apparent to you, what many people start doing is they start trying to do that. However, they might still be conceited, they might still be selfish, they might still be attached, but they're trying to move into a supportive or lighter state of being. And through that effort, through that attention, eventually they start to recognize that it's actually in poor taste to be judgmental of people, or it's in poor taste to harm people or situations. And so holding the ideals of, for example, harmlessness or truthfulness, in the beginning, they might be kind of a dogmatic structure that keeps us going in a direction. But as that divinization starts to happen, it only feels right to speak the truth. It only feels right to do your best not to be harmful and to try to be helpful in the world. And it's not coming from a psychological complex where you feel you have to do it, otherwise you're sinful. You're expressing it just because deep down inside, that feels like the right thing to do.
Yeah, no, that's good. Let me put it in the context of my own experience. I was privileged. I think all of Yogananda's direct disciples are deceased now, but I've been privileged to be in the presence of Roy Eugene Davis, Brother Nanda Moy, and a few others, and then also a Buddhist monk I met from another tradition, and certainly Swami Nirvanananda, Richard Rohr would be another person. People who have attained a level of divinization, a level of God realization. And what I always experienced in their presence is I was never better than when I was in their presence. Mm. It was like getting caught up in their energy field. Everything that you were just describing happened. The fears fell away, you know, some of the neurotic knots fell away, the egoism fell away, because that's what they radiated, was everything that you were saying. So it's kind of funny. Whenever I, again, was in their presence, I was never better than right. when I was in their presence. And that said something about, to me, you know, that the proof was in the pudding, as they say, that being in their presence, seeing how they lived, seeing how they elevated people around them was the test. Yeah. And again, that's something that is available to all of us, not just the chosen few. We all have that divine spark. We all are divine at our deepest level, and right. we can nurture that. What have been, if I can be a little bit personal, what have been some of the challenges for you along the way? Because we all have challenges.
Some of the challenges. That's a hard one. I mean, what level are we talking about here? I mean, personally, I think I used to be kind of a judgmental, anxious, angry person. So sort of overcoming that was a difficulty. Is that what you're asking? Something like that? Yeah. Or do you mean something else?
Yeah, wherever you want to go with it.
Okay. Yeah. I think ultimately we all are different in that regard. And, you know, again, for me, sort of moving through some frustration in life and some anxiety and fears and so on, like that was my personal challenge. Whereas other people, you know, maybe they've had certain traumatic experiences that allow them to believe that, you know, they're less than what they are, or have a sense of shame and so on. It depends on everyone. But really, at the end of the day, through the practice of trying to make sense of the issues that you have, rise above them and sort of transcend them. And I don't mean ignore them. I don't mean sort of stuff them down and pretend they're not there. I mean, actually look at them and work through them. You know, in that way, we sort of become more fit to process higher states of consciousness. So anyone, you know, wherever you are, this is the thing that I don't think a lot of people fully understand. Wherever you are, if you want to know what you have to do to process higher states of consciousness, just look at your life and see, where are your hangups? Where do you feel excessive anxiety, depression, fear, anger, or any of these things? Wherever you feel that for you, that is the blueprint, the roadmap of this is what you need to work on. Because when you clear that up, it'll make it much easier for you to just to recognize when you hear a spiritual teacher say, you can be at peace. Well, once you clear those things up and you practice your meditation, then you recognize, oh, that teacher was accurate. I actually can be at peace. So it's always going to be different for everyone.
Yeah, I brought it up because I had a conversation with somebody yesterday, and it mirrors my own experience, that there's almost a thought that as we begin to evolve spiritually, we just transcend. You know, it's like glory to glory. And there's an element of that that's true. But also as the consciousness expands, you become more aware of where the kinks are, where the knots are, where your shadows are. And it's not about shaming yourself or, you know, being self-critical, but to be able to face those issues, those feelings, and to bring them into consciousness and to understand how they work, to see how the tentacles kind of have a grip on your life. But from that bigger place of peace, that bigger place of compassionate witnessing, then you can begin to untangle the knots and be free. But again, I wanted to stress that because there is this notion that you begin to meditate and, you know, a year or two, you'll be enlightened and you'll just transcend.
Yeah, that was not my experience.
Not my experience. But that when those things come up, it doesn't mean we're getting it wrong. It means that we're getting it right.
Right.
And then you just bring it all into consciousness. And again, and then the knots, it's much easier to untie the knots.
Yeah. Can I say one more thing about that?
Sure.
You know, one thing I've noticed, like you said, and I had this experience too, you imagine once you start meditating, doing these things, that it is going to be clearer and freer from one day to the next. And I wasn't being 100% honest there. Just by making the effort and trying, I did feel more clarity as I went, you know, as I continued to meditate and remain, you know, steady on the course. But then, you know, there comes a time where you kind of just want to be done with problems, or at least this is my experience. And you just want to be done with, you know, why am I still hitting, you know, this problem, or why does this thing still trigger me? And a lot of people get there and that keeps happening. And they're expecting their spiritual path or their meditation technique to just obliterate all of that. And they eventually give up because they have a false expectation about what your spiritual path is supposed to do. But if they can stop and if they can quit thinking, what do I need to do to get away from all of these problems? And instead look at each one by one, and attend to it and take care of it, even if it takes a long time, then what happens is it starts to become very clear that anything that's presented to you, the neighbor comes by and does something, it triggers you. Well, in the past, you could think, why is that happening again? I've got to go meditate. But maybe you could stop and you can say, wait a minute, if it's triggering me, there must be something there that hasn't been resolved yet. And then you look at it, and then the neighbor becomes a blessing, or something happens with your vehicle and you get frustrated, that becomes a blessing, or something happens unexpected that you couldn't even possibly dream of. And it triggers a whole wave of things that make you feel like you are not what you are, which is a free spiritual being. You can stop and you can look at it and then address it. And then each time you address it, you become freer. And then the next time it doesn't bother you, until eventually all those things kind of get those knots, as you mentioned, or those strings get untangled, and then you're free. And that's the meditation practice, the moral disciplines and so on. Those are the parts that keep you moving forward and energize you and support you in the process of doing what the work is, which is living through processing all that stuff that you think is a problem.
No, that's good. I remember having this experience many, many years ago. Probably one of my knots was anger. Yeah. I could easily get angry and, you know, kind of blow my way through things. And I remember kind of had one day feeling, I don't remember what triggered it, but feeling the anger rising. And this thought just kind of trickled down. And the thought said, do you really need to be angry right now? Is it necessary? It was really the thought. And it was like, oh, no. But then there was the realization that I had, you know, my pattern was solving problems that were complicated or frustrating through anger. And it was like, I don't really need to be angry anymore to resolve these kinds of conflicts.
Right.
But I don't know that would have happened, that moment of realization would have happened if I wasn't meditating, like you're saying, practicing a moral life that energizes your life and your consciousness to move in that direction, that allows you to be open to moments of grace like that, moments of illumination. So I hope this is a good question, doesn't put you on the spot too much. If you had to reduce your spiritual life, your spiritual practice to three principles, three realities, three something practices that have really kind of grounded you, guided you, and steadied you. You had to reduce it to three phenomenons.
Three. Okay.
You could do more. I'm just
I think three is good, and might as well keep it, you know, pared down to something manageable. It is funny though, because as I was thinking about this interview, and I've been going through the Holy Science more, and I've been sort of overwhelmed by the fact of how immense the practice actually is in the totality of your life, I thought, how are we going to talk about this? So you've just made me boil it down to three things. So what would that be? The first one would be to be as, and this is all one thing, truthful and as authentic as you can be, meaning wherever you are, at whatever stage you're at, be as truthful and as authentic with yourself and with others as you can be. I think that's probably the first one. The second one would be to really give yourself permission to develop the skill, more than likely through meditation, to turn your attention within and find a way to let go of absolutely everything, even if it's just for 5 minutes every day, to practice feeling the experience of being free and letting go of absolutely everything. And I don't mean giving up responsibilities that you need to be responsible for. I mean, just taking some time to exist freely internally, right? So truthfulness, being able to exist internally. And then probably the last one would simply be to be patient, because it's often thought that this process should be quick. You know, there's all kinds of people on YouTube and writing books and all over the place who promise these quick results. And my experience has been, at least for me, is that the process is hard work. And the people whom I've known who have been successful, it's been a lifelong endeavor. It's not just been something they've done for 2 or 3 years. It's something that they are steady with. And so patience would be, well, I think that's really it. It's just like when you have a good relationship. The good relationship develops because you patiently learn and grow about yourself and about your partner. And so if you are able to practice this truthfulness, this authenticity, and if you're able to train yourself to be free internally, it's not immediately going to give you a zap of enlightenment. But as the years go by, if you can just watch, if you can just wait, just like you're trying to watch a tree grow. I just planted a sycamore tree. And it's just this tall. And, you know, I wish it was going to be huge next year, but it's probably going to be 20 or 30 years before that gets in any size that I'll say, wow, that's an amazing tree in regards to girth and so on. But you have wait and you watch and you let it happen. So truthfulness, internalizing your awareness and patience, those would probably be the three main things.
So I think they're great. If I can make a couple of comments. First one, truth. First of all, it takes a lot of courage to be truthful. Mm-hmm. But what I tell people is that all roads lead to Rome, as a metaphor. So as we start to tell truths, our own truths, we're truthful with ourselves, first of all, more and more light opens up, more and more truth comes, more and more light opens up, and then we find ourselves really living in the flow of this dynamic truth. Yogananda, I'm paraphrasing, but it's pretty close to a quote. He said that truth is in direct correspondence to reality, but he used an uppercase R for reality. That so every little truth that we have the courage to speak, first of all, to ourselves, most importantly, and then to live, it aligns us more and more with the greater reality, uppercase R, the divine, unity, consciousness, etc. There's a line by Jesus, you know, he said, you'll know the truth will set you free. I don't think he was primarily talking about dogmatic truth, but just this flow of truth that leads to more and more truth. So I love that. Secondly, one of the things I do with our people, and I do with myself here at the Assisi Institute, is I tell them, just take a couple of minutes and imagine what it'd be like to be enlightened. Imagine what it'd be like to have no fears, no insecurities, to be really free and peaceful and spontaneous in the best sense. Imagine, because I think even that experience, I think this is what you're saying, begins to transform our consciousness.
Yeah.
Creates new neural pathways in the brain, etc.
Right.
And patience does not come easy for me, but I say it's one of those, it's not a sexy virtue, yeah, but it's absolutely essential.
Right.
One time, when Roy was alive, I asked him this question, like, when will I be fully enlightened? And he just said, when it happens and not before.
That's good.
And there's something about patience that really is really at some levels letting go and trusting the process, trusting the divine in the process, that speeds up the process paradoxically.
Well, you know, that idea of patience and what you said, when is it going to happen? You know, that's a great thing to consider. And it also helps to bring into, I think, focus, you know, what is your real goal or what do you really want? You know, for example, if I want to learn to play a song on an instrument that's really difficult, well, if I really want to do it, I'm not sitting there thinking, well, when am I going to do it? I recognize that every time I sit down to learn a little bit of that song, I'm getting closer and closer to it. And I know that one day I'll be able to play it. I don't know when. But when people ask me things like, how long is it going to take? Well, my response typically is, if you're worried about how long it's going to take, you're probably not willing to do it because you're eventually going to stop.
Well, and this is a cliche, but, you know, the process is part of the path, and enjoying the process and each moment in the process is really part of the path. Yeah. And also, I think in the same context, what I tell people is, when you meditate, even if you have a just a minute of peace and freeness and peace, even if you have just a minute of peace and stillness and freedom, that minute is going to propel you to more minutes. So it's trusting the process and trusting grace in the midst of the process.
Yeah.
There's another question. We're not really changing gears, but just a different emphasis. One of the things, Ryan, that I see in your life and that I respect is that you're not just about meditating. You're not just about the internal journey, interior journey, as important as that is, but that your life is also in service. Can you say something about service in the process of our spiritual evolution?
Yeah. So the biggest problem that we have, at least from what I remember Roy saying, Mr. Davis, was that we think we are a little limited a little limited person that's trying to get resources and get ahead of everyone and think that they're important and these kinds of things. And there are other spiritual teachers, obviously, who have said that exact same thing. You know, for example, one of my friends used to say, the biggest sin there is the sin of I, me, and mine. And that always stuck with me. And the reason service is so important is because it's recognizing that you are not a little alienated, isolated being, that you are part of a wholeness. And the way I look at service, you know, you can look at what I do and look at it as spiritual service, because I do offer a lot of classes and retreats and podcasts and write books and things on spiritual topics. And that is service. However, you know, I'm also a musician. And my sense is that even when I play music, that is offering service. And I don't do kirtan. I'm not chanting Sita and Rama all the time. I'm playing things like Irish music. But what I found is that when I'm in a situation and I have that opportunity to play that music, people come up to me afterwards and they're just, it takes them to a place of clarity. It takes them to a place where they're just, one of the last shows I did, someone came up to us and said, you know, that felt like my DNA just got flossed. And that's a really great thing to hear. But I come at it as though I don't really care if people are looking at me as this musician. I just want to contribute maybe a moment or an afternoon of enjoyment of this music. And the reason I'm kind of going down this path is because we all have something. It doesn't have to be labeled as spiritual. that is service. You know, a family member who's taking care of another family member, someone who is an engineer and they love engineering. Well, even though they're getting paid for it, that is divine service. Because of your engineering, we have computers and we have the internet and we have the ability to do things like this. So service, I think, is really important on the grand scheme of things, so that we recognize that we are part of a greater whole, that we are part of a consciousness, that humanity is a wholeness. But on another level, I think it's important for people to recognize that service doesn't have to be like you are Mother Teresa. Service is, are you living your life in such a way that you realize that you are important, that this limited part of you, the small self, actually participates in a grand organism. And whatever skills you have or capacities you have, if you know that you're participating, supporting this wholeness of life, then anything you do becomes service.
Yeah, I'll share an experience I had literally 35 years ago. And it really left an impression because I'm sharing it 35 years later. I was having a bad day. I don't remember why I was having a bad day. And I was in the grocery store and I sneezed. And this African-American gentleman was walking towards me and he looked me in the eye and he just said, "God bless you." And I swear I felt Shakti coming from him and my mood disappeared. So my point is to people is, how you treat the people in your life, how you interact, do it with loving, kindness, truthfulness, humility, compassion, then everything becomes a service.
Right.
And you can, and it's living your daily life in the circumstances, not from that place of I, me, but just being your best self to everyone around you in all of the simplest and humblest of ways. And if I go to a little bit to the grand level, and my guess is you probably experienced this too, is there's a certain ceiling I hit in my work as a spiritual teacher, as a Kriya teacher. And I just feel like I'm in over my head and I can't do it, or I'm not worthy to do it, whatever the language is. But then there's always this realization at the egoic level, that's true. But to what you were saying, we're not the ego. We're not these limited psyches. We're not the body per se. We are connected to everything and all the resources that are in the heart and soul of creation. So the ego hits a limitation. Once we accept the ego's limitation, then it opens us up to go beyond, that it's not me, this little person doing it, but it's a greater self doing it through me.
Right.
And I'm inseparable from that greater self.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, when you think about the three pillars of Kriya Yoga, tapas, which is your spiritual practice and sort of purification of your life, svadhyaya, which is your study, your understanding of scripture, but also the study of yourself. And the final one, Ishvara Pranidhana, it's often translated as surrender in God. Now, I personally don't like that translation because Ishvara isn't just God the way most people think of it. Ishvara, in my experience, is this infinite intelligence, infinite wisdom, infinite energy that it makes all of this possible. It can perception, everything makes it all possible. And so it's incomprehensible in a way. But really what Ishvara Pranidhana means, instead of surrender in God, if you look at it on a real technical level, we'll get technical for a minute. In the Sanskrit, in the Yoga Sutras, it is transferring your identity from the small sense of self to the wholeness. It's a transfer of identity. And so when you're able to let go of the small sense of self and let that infinite consciousness, in a way, to me, it sort of feels like it's sort of pouring through, you know, it's kind of coming from behind and pouring through, but it's infinite. You can't conceive of it, but it's back there coming through. You transfer your identity to that. Then you're practicing Ishvara Pranidhana, surrender in God, or the ultimate kind of service. And once you have that experience, and they say in the Yoga Sutras that one becomes a svaman or a swami, which is one who is in service to the self, right? Yes. It's a realization of a transfer that it's not the little you doing anything, but it is this incomprehensible consciousness or the divine or God that makes all this happen. But it's the knowing, the realization, the recognition, oh, that's what's going on. That's when, in a way, you are enlightened to a higher reality. You know, it's yes. kind of fascinating.
A little technique that I practice sometimes, and I also will do in groups, is have a conversation. And don't use any personal pronouns. Mm. Don't use I, me, or my, or we. No personal pronouns. And it's a little clumsy at first, but what you begin to experience after a while is you begin to expand. That the identification with the I, the little I, which is different than the I that Ramana Maharshi talks about. But the identification with the little I keeps you identified with the little I and keeps you imprisoned. And the less we use the word I, me, and my in our conversations and eventually even in our thinking, it opens up to that greater field of consciousness. So do you want to say anything about we're not going to talk about the details of the technique right now, but the primary Kriya Pranayama technique, how that fits into all of this?
Yeah, absolutely. But before I say anything, just those of you who are listening, what I'm about to say is an extreme oversimplification. So I'll do my best though. So if we use a theory or the model, a theory or model of Samkhya philosophy, or a model of creation, the idea that there is this infinite cosmic being that is pure and it's full of truth, it is truth, it's beyond time, space, it's beyond comprehension. And in this theory, something happens, which you figure out as you meditate, and then creation begins to come about. And what's happening is there's a current or there is a flow from this infinite incomprehensible into creation. It's like it's described as a current, like a river or a current of a river, and it's flowing down into creation. However, there's another current which is flowing back. It's flowing back to source, and it's always happening. So it's not necessarily that it's better whether you're going one way or the other way. You're always somewhere in this current. In the Yoga Sutras, there are these terms, boga and apavarga. And boga means experience or enjoyment, and apavarga means like emancipation or freedom. And according to the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, creation, like what we're experiencing, what we can touch, feel, taste, get mad at, love, and so on, that the creation exists for two reasons. One is boga, or experience, or happiness. The other is for emancipation, freedom. And so when you are caught up in the world, you know, you want to go have a bunch of babies, you want to be seen as someone famous, you want to have a lot of money, you want to be secure in your house, all these things, the things that you want to do in the world, you're caught up in boga, the outward flowing current. And when you are letting go of those things, you're not necessarily so enamored with them. You have a greater sense of joy in being, or simpler things in life, or spiritual practice. That means that essentially you're catching the current of apavarga, or moving back to source. So that's just to set the stage. Now, in the Kriya Yoga tradition, we do a technique where it's like circulating life force through the spinal pathway. And the spinal pathway is said to be the river, a sacred river, essentially. And life flows down through the crown and the sixth chakra, the medulla oblongata, and so on, down into the body, down out into the nerves, so that you can feel, touch, see, taste things. And so as life force is flowing down, then you're involved in creation. And so that's fine, no problems with that. But in the Kriya Yoga practice, and one who's engaged in the spiritual path, the idea is to reverse that flow, to let go of attachment to the senses, to the need to feel success in the world or be validated in the world, and so on. And so the techniques themselves, whether it's the Kriya Pranayama that you learn in initiation, or even chanting through the chakras, all of this is directing your awareness back into the center and moving it from the senses into the center, back up to source. So in a nutshell, what's happening when you practice the Kriya Yoga techniques is you are encouraging your awareness on the current of apavarga, of freedom, of emancipation, and you are letting go of the current of boga, of getting caught up in the wheel of change and the wheel of sorrow and the ups and downs of life. You're letting go of that. You're choosing what is more important from a spiritual perspective, which is source. And in the holy science, Sri Yukteswar quotes a Bible passage. I really need to memorize it because I really love the quote. He essentially says, sort of from the words of God in this Bible passage, that I have nothing against you except that you left your first love. And the first love is spirit. And he says, you've left the first love. That means you're starting to believe that all of these things that are temporary are real and important. That's when you leave your first love. And so part of the spiritual practice is to recognize, oh, maybe I need to go back to my first love. So that's what the Kriya techniques are supposed to do.
Yeah, and let me just comment that there's a paradox in all of this, that when we make that decision, both through lifestyle and through practice, Kriya Pranayama, to go back to the source, to go back to, I like that, our first love and our primary love, there's something paradoxical that happens. We then become more efficient on a practical sense in our lived life, but we also become more of a source of light and love and grace for other people. So that's the paradox. The more we let go of this world and make that journey back to our first love, then we become a more finely tuned instrument of love and wisdom and truth in the world. That's the grand paradox.
Yeah.
If we think of our you know, some of our spiritual heroes, like the Kriya Gurus, etc., they had a profound impact on people because they were living out of the consciousness of their first love,
right,
of the source, of the divine. That's the whole paradox to the spiritual life. It's not an escape, but it actually allows us to walk the earth as gods, to go back to something I said at the very beginning, to be a divine presence within the world.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's an important distinction, because a lot of people think that spirituality is often not life affirming, like it's life denying.
Yes.
And it's actually not. It's just, you know, in order to, Sri Yukteswar, he talks about how, you know, this world is really meant to fulfill your heart's desire. Right. That's why it's here. You know, that's why I said there's no problem with boga or enjoyment or experience, because it's part of God divinity too. It's just the ever-changing aspect of it. And if we are able to recognize what we truly are, which is spirit, then we can behave. I don't want to use the word appropriately, because that sounds kind of dogmatic. We can behave tastefully, knowing how to relate to the world, you know, from this spiritual perspective, this higher perspective. And then when you go and you play music, you're free. You're not doing it to be anything, to change anything. You're just a pure expression.
Which makes you a better musician, because the ego is out of the way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Everything gets better when you get rid of that.
it's really incredible. You know, there's a story, I think I told you the story, my first time I went down to Roy's place. There was a retreat. And at the last day, we all went around and we got to introduce ourselves a bit more personally. And there was a guy sitting next to me, and he said, well, I want to evolve because I want to get out of this world. And you know what, like when you were a kid in grammar school and somebody said something stupid, you knew that they were going to, it was like, and Roy paused and he said, well, you must not be that evolved, really. And the guy said, why? He said, and Roy said, because when you're enlightened, you can be in hell and still be at peace.
Right. That's good.
Anyways, but I think that fits into what you're saying. And just a little segue, you've mentioned a number of times Sri Yukteswar's book, The Holy Science. It's funny, it's on the table right next to me where I meditate every day. And I just want to say a little bit about that and some of the other Kriya readings, but if you want to chime in, the traditions that have been passed on to us in Kriya Yoga and this whole lineage from the Bhagavad Gita to Roy's writings, Yogananda's writings, Sri Yukteswar's Holy Science, they are really gems of wisdom and truth and beauty. And I find sometimes just by opening up and reading one line from Sri Yukteswar's Holy Science, it just poof, takes me, there's an energy and a grace that just takes me in a whole different direction. So I just really encourage people to make it a part of their life. And you don't have to be a scholar, but just to spend some time, even if it's just a few minutes every day, reading the words of these great masters. You know, at the Assisi Institute, we integrate a lot of, you know, mystical Christianity, so the writings of St. Francis or Jesus, for example. But just when you talked about Sri Yukteswar's Holy Science, it is such a treasure trove. And just connecting in a contemplative, meditative way with these writings, there really is grace. There's a level of Shakti that propels us on the journey. I don't know if you want to say anything about that.
No, I think I've had that similar experience. And you know, one of the things that Yogananda had said to Mr. Davis was, you know, read a little, meditate more, and think of God all the time. That was one of the things that Yogananda had said to our teacher, Mr. Davis. And read a little, sure, it means to read spiritual literature and so on. But when you read material like the Holy Science, that's not easily grasped stuff. You know, and a lot of the writings of spiritual teachers, you read them and in the beginning, maybe there is a sense of wholeness to it, a sense of this really is profound, but then you don't really quite get it. And part of the experience of making it alive, at least for me, was reading something just a little bit and then wondering about it. I don't know what he's talking about when he starts talking about what the Ahamkara is and how it relates to the sons of God and so on. But the more I sat with it and I wondered, what does that mean? What that's doing is it's energizing the experience. And since consciousness is sort of self-referring, I suppose, when you wonder about something, when you think about something, it brings it into your awareness. And so if you wonder about these higher principles, these higher ideals, and you don't know what they mean, but you believe you can know what they mean, meaning you feel in your heart like, I don't get it, but I really think I can. You don't just exist in a state of doubt like that's beyond me, because that kind of blocks it out a little bit. But if you read it and wonder, well, what is this? You know, it took me 20 years before I even thought I had a slight understanding of what the Holy Science was about. And the book is only that big, you know, it's only so thick. So I think it's really important to, as you mentioned, keep the writings and contemplate the material, but also keep it in your space. You know, in my life, everywhere I am, I've got, you know, a picture of Sri Yukteswar on a book. I've got Ramana Maharshi behind me, or by my bedside, I have a stack of books of Mr. Davis's and Yogananda's and so on. And when I go into the bathroom, they're right there. And when I sit down on the couch, they're right on the side there. And everywhere I go, like, I see these energies, you know, I see these sort of vessels of knowledge. And so it keeps it fresh in my awareness. So there's a lot to be said for doing that.
Well, and I'll tell you an experience that somebody shared with me, a person in the Assisi Institute who's very, very devotional, I'll say it that way. She said to me, I have a hard time reading Roy's books because they're kind of dry. And so what I said was, well, read them after you meditate. And lo and behold, this is a true story. She came back and said to me, I get it now. reading his words from that silence, from that meditative space, he said it's made all the difference in the world.
Right.
So again, it's not reading from the analytical mind, but from the place of silence and stillness. And even if you don't always understand the words, there's something intuitively happening. Something is happening at some subtle level. Well, we've covered a lot of ground. Is there anything else you want to share or hone in on before we bring it to a close?
Yeah, ultimately, I would say, while Kriya Yoga is a very powerful spiritual path, that the mechanics of all authentic spiritual paths are the same. And they all kind of boil down to being a good person. And by good, I don't mean, you know, moral dogmas again. I just mean someone who is kind and thoughtful and really striving to understand themselves, just the sense of self-understanding, but also to have a discipline and a practice, because that discipline, that practice helps to carry the intention of where you're going. And when I was younger, you know, I was learning to mountain bike, and I wasn't doing very well, and I was getting ready to veer off the trail and go over into the canyon, and the person behind me yelled, and he said, "Look where you're going, not where you don't want to go." And that stuck with me. And so I think one of the things that our spiritual path can do is it can help us focus in on where we really want to go. And when you focus on where you really want to go, you end up sort of missing or not getting so tangled up in the things that aren't helpful for you. So ultimately, I think it's important just to have a vision of your life and a vision of possibilities, and know that you can get there. You just take some time and stay true, you know, stay aware and stay engaged and stay curious about it. And if that's the case, you know, this whole life will become what it's meant to, which is an opportunity to learn and grow and wake up to what you really are, which is from the human side to the devata or the angelic, and then eventually to the sannyasin, you know, the supremely free. That's why we're all here. And all spiritual paths, all authentic spiritual paths can take us there. But we do have to keep it in our consciousness that is what is going on. I think that's the most important thing.
Absolutely. I like what you said. Don't look at where you don't want to go. Look at where you want to go. What is your guiding North Star? And it shouldn't be what you're afraid of. It should be what you're longing for, what you love, and what's speaking to your soul. Perfect. Do you want to say a little bit just about your ministry? If people want to contact you, connect with you online, how they can do that?
Yeah, there's all kinds of ways. The Kriya Yoga podcast. So if you look on iTunes or Spotify or Podbean, it's the Kriya Yoga podcast. Right now, there's about 108 episodes, and Craig has been on at least two of those that I recall. So they're well worth tuning into to kind of help keep you inspired and provide information. We have a Patreon community, patreon.com/Kriya Yoga. And that community, we have monthly Q&As. I put out a monthly class just for the Patreon members and all different kinds of interesting things. And then finally, for those people who are really interested in digging deep into Kriya Yoga, I offer a Kriya Yoga discipleship course through Teachable and a 2-year Kriya Yoga apprenticeship course. So there's multiple ways to learn Kriya Yoga and to participate and to find me, but those are probably the best ways.
Good. And I'll repeat what I said at the beginning. I think you are a wonderful ambassador for Kriya Yoga. So I encourage anybody that's interested to follow through with you. So I want to thank you. Again, you are a dear brother on this path. And if you've liked this podcast, please give it a like, make a comment, and share it with somebody. So thank you. Namaste. God bless everybody. God bless you, Ryan.